Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Okay, so we're lucky to be joined by Ian Shepherdson, who is the chief economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics.
Pantheon, we cover all the major economies, but I just write exclusively about the US, despite being, as you can definitely tell, very British.
Tell listeners a little bit about you. They probably noticed your lovely accent, and we should note the fact that you're talking to us from the UK, although you are a master in all things US economy. Tell us a little bit about where you are and who you are.
Yeah, so I've been writing about the US economy every day for the last 20-something years, entirely by accident, as these things always happen. So I lived and worked in the US for a few years, and I outsourced myself back to Britain back in the early part of the century. So I guess, you know, on average, I find myself somewhere above Greenland. I think that's where I am probably more often than anywhere else on the ground.
And where are you right now?
Right now, I'm in the frozen north. I'm in Newcastle. I'm looking out on the Tyne River, or as we would call it in England, the River Tyne. And I'm just wondering whether it will stop raining before I go home.
Probably not.
Probably not. It never does.
It never does, yeah. Lots of places we could go to talk about the U.S. economy and markets and Donald Trump and everything that's going on in the world right now. But let's start with the big picture on the U.S. economy. We just got a GDP report, gross domestic product, that was pretty good, 3.5% growth. I don't think anybody would really complain about that, but it was down from 4.2% in the second quarter. And there were some worrying numbers in there, particularly on capital expenditures, which grew at a lot slower pace than people were expecting. Ian, should we be worried right now about a slowdown in the U.S. economy?
Yes and no. I'm going to hedge my bets here. And I'm also going to be one of the people who does complain about that second quarter number, the third quarter number, because it was paid for with a lot of borrowed money, which has driven up consumption to an insane 4%. Hasn't really done anything for business capital spending, even though the administration said it would, and has therefore given us a fast-growing but very unbalanced economy that's running on sugar, which will run out. So not only am I kind of upset about the structure of the growth, the type of growth that we've got, but I also don't think it's going to last for very much longer, which you might think, well, okay, what's he complaining about? If it's going to slow down, then that's fine. But when it slows down, what we'll be left with is a legacy of a huge amount of extra borrowed money that didn't need to be borrowed, that's made the labor market tighter than it otherwise would have been. It's pushing the Fed into a corner, which, of course, the president doesn't like, and hasn't done anything at all to address the structural problems in the economy. So I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but I kind of do feel like one at the moment.
Well, you're in good company among curmudgeons. I've been accused of being that in the past. Talk to me a little bit more about the consumer number in that GDP report, because it was very good. People are spending a bunch of money, which sounds like a good thing. You know, we generally like that. But as you say, maybe it can't last. How much of this economic growth in the third quarter was driven by consumer spending versus, say, businesses spending on stuff?
Sure. Well, the consumer is always the biggest bit of the economy. You know, almost $7 out of every 10 that's spent in the U.S. is spent by consumers. So that it's always going to be the biggest single component of growth. What makes it look unsustainable over the summer was that consumption grew much more quickly than incomes. So in the medium term, you can only spend what you earn. And right now, income growth adjusted for inflation, taking account of taxes, is running at about 2.5%. But spending recently in both the second and third quarters is running at about 4%. Now, you can do that for a while. If you throw enough money at people through tax cuts, which their grandchildren will be paying for, then yeah, people can spend more than their income for a while, and they can be very happy, and the consumer confidence is very high. They can save a bit less, and they can go on a bit of a spending spree. And we've certainly seen that. And that's great if you're a retailer. It's great if you're selling services, if you're in the hotel business, the restaurant business. Great. You know, what are you going to be complaining about? Nothing. You've got more people coming through the door, spending more money. But I'm going to put my macro hat on and step back and say, look, this is not sustainable. We can't have consumer spending running at 4% when income growth is trending at about 2.5%. And we certainly can't have consumer spending running at 4% when the economy doesn't have the ability to provide all the stuff people want to buy. So one of the other consequences is going to be, or is already, a widening out in the trade deficit. which is politically unfortunate, of course, because the president believes that the trade account is some sort of profit and loss measure and gets very upset when the deficit rises. But it's going to rise for the foreseeable future if all we're doing is pumping up consumption and we're not generating the ability of the economy to supply everything people want at the same time. And that's where this business investment thing comes into the story, because we need businesses to invest, to add capacity, to renew the capital stock, to buy new stuff that they can make more stuff with. And that's not really happening in the way the administration thought after they cut business taxes back in December. Just to give you a bit of background, business spending has been rising since early 2016. The numbers are lumpy. So when I see one weak quarter, and the third quarter was definitely weaker than I hoped, I'm not going to start getting upset that it's some sort of major structural change. You know, it could easily rebound in the fourth quarter. The trend has been okay. The problem is that it hasn't got any better since we threw all this money at businesses. What they seem to have done instead is either sat on the cash or used it for buybacks or dividends. They're not, or they don't seem to be spending any more money on equipment and new software or whatever than they would have done otherwise. And so it's kind of a big bust with an awful lot of other people's borrowed money.
Yeah, I mean, the big argument for the supply side tax cut that the Trump administration pushed and that Congress enacted into law was, we will unleash the animal spirits and the business community will have a revolution in capital expenditures, and people will open new plants and buy new stuff and in turn hire more people and pay them more money. What you're saying is that we're not seeing that yet. Is that right?
Yeah, we're not seeing anything over and above what we were seeing before. You know, capital spending started to rise. It slowed down a lot, actually, during the period when oil prices fell very sharply, 2014, 2015. That was a big, caused a big correction in capital spending. But that hit bottom in early 2016, before the election, at a time when most people thought Hillary Clinton would be president. And it's gone up on a year-over-year basis pretty much in a straight line. But there's no inflection point. There's no extra growth since the tax cut. It's just carried on doing what it was doing before. Nobody looking at the period before the tax cut could look, you know, at a picture of business capital spending and say, hey, there's clearly a tax cut happened here because look at the way spending has shot up since it was enacted. That just hasn't happened. Not at all.
Okay, so President Trump is spending a lot of time now tweeting and saying that if Democrats make gains in the midterm elections, particularly win the House of Representatives, which is what a lot of people think is going to happen, that markets and the economy will go into the tank, that we'll lose whatever gains we had, you know, since he's been president, economic growth will slow and stock prices will fall. Do you believe any of that?
I'm struggling with that idea. You know, markets aren't dumb. They can read the same polls as everybody else. They know that there's, at the moment, a very high probability that Democrats will take the House. But there's an equally, almost equally high probability that they won't take the Senate. So we're not going to see the sudden implementation of some sort of very progressive Democrat agenda. That's just not going to happen. It couldn't get through the Senate, even if the House passes all sorts of exciting things. So I think from a sort of a rational market perspective, that news is pretty much in the price at this point. What's hurt the stock market recently, I don't think, is fear of the outcome of the midterm elections. It's instead a recognition that that interest rates are going to keep rising, that the Fed actually is serious when they say they plan to hike interest rates again in December and then three times next year. So that'll make four increases this year, three next year. Markets are starting to think that that's actually going to happen, and that when it does happen, it's a threat to the business sector. It's a threat to future earnings growth. At the very same time that a lot of companies are complaining about the disruption being caused by tariffs and fear of more tariffs to come. And also at the same time that a lot of businesses are facing increasing labor costs. So they're kind of thinking we're being hit from all sides here. And the political environment, I think, is the very smallest of all those issues facing companies. You know, when you read business surveys, it's not fear of the midterms that's making them nervous. It's fear of tariffs and labor costs and actually just finding anybody to come and work for them. That's what really is concerning businesses now. And as we all know, as stuff gets more scarce, it becomes more expensive. And that applies to labor just like it applies to, you know, components coming from China. So businesses are facing kind of a broad threat to margins, which have been great. Earnings this year are spectacular, but looking ahead, they're not going to be so spectacular. And I think that's what the market's reacting to, irrespective of the political story.
And on the Fed, the president is spending a lot of time bashing the Fed and Fed Chairman Jay Powell in particular, saying it's their fault that markets are declining. And as you say, there may be some in market action that's reflective of the Fed raising interest rates. But Trump is clearly not happy with this interest rate hiking campaign. Is the Fed doing something unusual or bad here?
No, I mean, the easy metric here is to just compare the level of interest rates, you know, adjusted for inflation, which is zero right now. So we've got 2% interest rates, 2% inflation, real interest rates are zero. And then compare that to where the labor market is, which is unemployment almost down to a 50-year low and still dropping like a stone, payroll growth very strong, and wage increases finally beginning to pick up. And say to yourself, have we ever had that combination before? And the answer is no. Interest rates in that environment of labor market tightness have always been much higher than they are now. So the Fed, when they talk about normalizing, that really is what they're doing. They're not doing anything that's outrageous by any sort of macro standards at all. I could quite happily make the case that they're actually a little bit behind. I know inflation today is 2%. It's on the target. It's kind of going sideways. But you've got to think a long way ahead here because the labor market generates inflation slowly and interest rates take a long time to take effect. And various Fed officials have made the point that they have to take account of these lags. You can't wait until inflation pokes you in the eye before you do something about it, which means that at some point in the cycle, you're going to be doing things which might look a bit, you know, unfortunate to the guy in the street who doesn't maybe appreciate the intricacies of monetary policy and maybe doesn't understand what you're doing. And I guess at this point, the president falls into that category as well.
And what about those who argue that, okay, inflation is at 2%, basically at the Fed's target, and unemployment is as low as you say it is, but that there is still slack in the labor market, that there are a huge number of people who left the labor force and haven't come back. And if the Fed would just slow down a little bit, maybe pause its interest rate hiking campaign, that you'd eventually draw those people back into the labor force. Do you have any sympathy for that argument?
I would really love to see that happen, you know, but it's an argument that you could have made at any point in the last 4 or 5 years. Labor participation, you know, has been flatlining for a long time now, despite endless forecasts that this is the time when it's got to go up. And so it's been a course of great frustration to economists and to the Fed. You know, we're looking at this environment where companies are screaming from the rooftops that they need more people to hire. They're expecting to pay more. They are paying more. They're telling you, you know, if you've got a pulse, you can get a job. And yet, you know, depends how you measure it, but maybe a couple of million people are missing from the labor force who we'd otherwise expect to be there. Now, there's a lot of competing explanations for this, but the one that makes most sense to me is the astonishing and awful increase in the number of people who are addicted to opioids. Those numbers have just exploded in the last few years, and that explosion fits the timing and the scale of the shortfall in the number of people in the labor force that we'd otherwise would expect. So, you know, officially, there's almost 3.5 million people addicted to opioids in the U.S. right now. The true number is certainly way higher than that. And 4 or 5 years ago, that number was much, much smaller, and that's the period over which labor participation has disappointed. So, unfortunately, it looks to me that unless and until the country really gets to grips with the opioid crisis very aggressively, we're kind of tying our hands behind our backs. We're not going to be able to pull those people into the labor force. And that means that the labor market actually is as tight as the data show. And if you're waiting for a big rise in participation to save you from wage cost pressure, I suspect you're going to be disappointed. This is not something we've ever had to deal with before. You know, in the past, typically, when GDP growth got up to 3%, you'd see people streaming into the labor force. And here we are now, we've done two quarters, back-to-back quarters, well in excess of 3%, and nobody has pitched up in the labor force. So something is going on here, and unfortunately, I think that the opioid crisis probably is the single best explanation for it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating insight to connect the decline in labor force participation to the opioid crisis, and assuming we'll see more work from economists on that front going forward. Let's play out the scenario for a minute where the Fed does decide to pause for whatever reason. They decide that financial market conditions are tightening given what's happened in the stock market. They decide that there is more room for the economy to grow faster, and they pause the interest rate hiking campaign. What is the, you know, the nightmare scenario where they get behind inflation? Like, what happens?
Yeah, well, like all these things, probably nothing happens on the day that they don't raise rates. There would be an immediate rally in the stock market unless they'd signaled it before. You know, let's say they don't hike rates in December like everyone expects they will at the moment. Let's say that, you know, in the weeks before that, we hear pretty clear hints they're not going to do it. Well, in advance of that decision, the stock market would rally and bond yields, well, they might come down, but it would depend on whether markets saw that as running an inflation risk. But I'm pretty sure there'd be a rally in the stock market. What would happen after that? Well, I guess it would mean that the fuel stays in the fire a little bit longer than it otherwise would have done. And so the risk is that further down the line, wage increases, which we're going to pick up anyway, accelerate a bit faster and a bit further. And maybe by next summertime, the Fed finds itself in a situation where it really, really needs to slow the economy down pretty quickly, because numbers which today look controlled suddenly don't look controlled. And one of the things that you need to be aware of, you know, as a policymaker, is that history tells you that when the labor market gets super tight, wage growth can accelerate very quickly. It maybe doesn't just keep rising in a gentle straight line. It kind of goes hockey stick, the wrong end of the hockey stick. And where you might be comfortable at wage growth running at 3 or 3.5%, you might blink and find it's 4.5%. And at that point, you're in real trouble. So the danger then of not taking action in a timely manner is that you have to do more action later. You have to do it more quickly and you have to go further. And when you do that, the range of possible outcomes for the economy and for the markets gets to be much bigger. Now, some of those outcomes might still be benign. You might still get the gentle slowdown that you want, but you might find yourself accidentally breaking the economy into little pieces. Because working out the reaction of the economy to big changes in interest rates and big swings in financial conditions is much more difficult than predicting what it's going to do if you're gently and predictably raising rates on a steady glide path, which is what they've done so far and what I'm pretty sure they'd like to continue doing. They know as well as anybody that delaying a hike, and then so that would make it 6 months between September and March. A lot can happen in the economy in 6 months, and I think they'd very much like to keep going if they can. Obviously, if the stock market really rolls over, and what we've had so far is a correction, not a rolling over. If it really rolls over, they'll pause. Yeah, they're not dumb. They're not masochists. But I think it would take quite a big hit. I think the bar to get the Fed to stop raising rates, to stop normalizing gently, is pretty high. And I don't think we've crossed that at this point.
All right. I think we've established that the Fed is not dumb and they're not masochists. As far as I know, both of those things are true. So let's talk a little bit more about the impact of tariffs and the trade war. Certainly in earnings calls we've heard recently from big companies, they're increasingly citing the impact of tariffs both on their own costs to produce things and their ability to sell into overseas markets, particularly China. And, you know, increased costs from tariffs are part of the inflation story. Talk to me a little bit more about the impact that tariffs are having right now and could have if the Trump administration goes forward with its plan to put another $260 billion plus in tariffs on Chinese imports, which would essentially be all the stuff we imported from China in the last year.
Yeah, that's a threat. And it's actually quite imminent. You know, the current tariff rate, the latest $200 billion of tariffs are tariffed at 10% in September. But the order announcing those tariffs says that in January 1, it goes to 25%. I'm hoping there'll be some negotiations with China that will stop that happening. And I'm really hoping those negotiations will prevent the extra tariffs coming in on the remaining $260 billion, because that's the stuff that would really have a massive impact on inflation. Right now, most of the stuff that tariffs have been applied to are raw materials or intermediate goods, components. There are a few consumer goods, but not many. Most of it is not directly consumer-facing products. So we haven't seen a huge spike in consumer inflation, the sole exception of washing machines, domestic washing machines, which were tariffed earlier this year. And then immediately, the year-over-year rate in the CPI for laundry equipment went from about -5, -6% up to +15. So I can just imagine if we saw that sort of swing in all the imported consumer goods in the CPI. That would be an enormous inflation hit overnight. Right now, no, it hasn't happened. You know, washing machines are a very, very small component of the core CPI. So if you were to look at inflation over the course of this year, you would not be able to see in the data that tariffs have been applied to imports, because they're stuff that's up the production chain. So it works through slowly, it works through gradually. If the price of machinery or equipment components has gone up, there'll be a gradual impact on inflation. But remember, most of the price of the stuff that we buy in the stores is labor rather than or components. And so we've been kind of protected on the consumer front. it's a different game altogether if we end up with 25% tariffs on consumer goods, because then the price of clothing and TVs and electronic gadgets and furniture and all sorts of other things will jump higher very quickly. Supply chains for these things are very short. It's not like it would take months and months. The hit to washing machine prices came through within a couple of months. So it would be immediate. It would be huge. No one could ignore it. It would be quite a disconcerting thing to walk into Walmart and find the price of everything's gone up by 25%. So this would be, I think, an enormous step in the wrong direction. That's why I think it won't happen. I suspect that neither the Chinese nor the US administration in their heart of hearts actually want to do this. And I suspect that we'll have some negotiations going which will allow both sides to pull back from the brink. But if they don't, it would be immensely disruptive. And the point is really that the disruption would be an order of magnitude bigger than what we've seen so far. What we've seen so far has been, you know, it's not a trade war, it's a skirmish. But it would become a war if we ended up with 25% tariffs on everything from China, with enormously adverse consequences. I think we'd see a huge drop in stock prices, real disruption in the economy, and a real mess. The Fed, by the way, would probably have to raise interest rates to deal with the inflation shock, even though the tariffs would be slowing growth down.
That's not what you would call a friendly scenario. If you've got the Fed forced to raise interest rates and prices on everything you buy at Walmart up 25%, I don't think I'd want to experience that.
No, I don't think anyone does. The problem is that you can, you know, two countries which are led by guys who think that appearance and face is the most important thing, not wanting to back down is a very awkward situation. So they need to find some way for both of them to kind of step back from this precipice, which I think would be very damaging to both economies, to consumers directly, and especially in the US case, you know, consumers do vote. Now, they'll have voted by the time these tariffs happen, but nonetheless, they do vote and they do notice. And of course, the Chinese view as well, we don't have to face a vote, so we can take this on the chin for longer than you can. I'm not sure that's true either. Neither party to a trade war benefits. And so I think, you know, it'll be avoided. But the consequences, if just working through the math of what would happen with full-bore tariffs, 25% on everything from China, I can't get away from the idea that it would be a massive hit to growth, a big hit to inflation, and higher interest rates all at once.
Let's talk about the fact that we're adding to the debt and deficit at pretty astonishing levels, given the amount of tax cuts that we enacted and the increased spending from Congress. Nobody seems to care about debt and deficit anymore. The Republicans pay lip service to it, but don't really care. And Democrats have never cared that much about it. But now we're looking at $1 trillion annual deficits as far as the eye can see, and going over $20 trillion in debt, and Treasury needing to borrow a ton to fund all of this. What are the risks to the economy from all that?
Well, the risks are that we finally realize that this has some sort of cost. But that's something that politicians have forgotten about for a very long time, because you have to go back really to the late 90s to see a period where there was any sort of vague relationship between the size of the deficit and the interest rate that the government had to pay to plug the hole. And then for a very long period, from about 2000 till very recently, the amount of the cost of borrowing in inflation adjusted yields on treasuries was falling, even though deficits were rising, and the gap between the two now is unrecognizable to anybody who'd been around in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s. They would say, well, yeah, how on earth are treasury yields so low? How on earth is the government borrowing at these very, very low rates when they've got so much debt that they need to sell? And there's a couple of reasons for it. First of all, the economy suffered a very long productivity slowdown from about 2000 till very recently. So that means, to be technical about it, productivity is kind of the long-run return on the economy. It's what we produce with the equipment and the software and all the stuff that we've got. And so the amount the economy produces per person is kind of a measure of the real return, the real growth in the economy in the long run. And over time, that ought to be equal to the cost of borrowed money. And it is, usually. And so when we've had a 17-year slowdown from the end of the productivity boom in the late 90s, when it was 3.5%, to the post-crash era until recently, it was more like zero. That was a big, big downward force on the cost of money, Great for the government, great for Congress, borrow loads of money, and you don't have to care what it costs. The second thing was China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 2001, started running enormous trade surpluses, finding its pockets stuffed full of dollars, which it then recycled back into the US by buying treasury debt. Great. Japan was doing the same thing at the same time. And then, after the crash, the Federal Reserve joined in with its quantitative easing, which, in other words, was buying a lot of treasuries. And so it turns out that during this period from about 2001 through 2015, those three parties, the Fed, China, and Japan, bought, well, almost half of all the debt. This is great if you've got a lot of debt to sell. You've got these buyers who were never there before. China and Japan and the Fed weren't buying in the 70s and 80s. But you've got these buyers who are willing to recycle, or in the Fed's case, to print money to buy huge amounts of treasuries and keep the cost down. Great. Okay, let's look at the situation now. So first of all, productivity growth is picking up. You know, finally, after a very long period of sluggishness, productivity growth is picking up. Businesses can't find people, so they've got to spend some money on equipment, and that's boosting productivity growth. Great, but it also means that the real cost of money should rise. Secondly, China's no longer buying treasuries. Japan's no longer buying treasuries. The Fed is actively shrinking its portfolio of treasuries. Now, they bought nearly half the debt over that previous 15, 16 years. Now they're not buying any. They're actually buying less than none. They're shrinking their stock. So the two big forces that held the cost of money down are disappearing, or actually reversing. And I'm really nervous. You want to know what keeps me awake at night is the idea that over the next few years, that gap between the size of the deficit and what it costs us to fund the deficit is going to narrow. And if it does narrow, then you're going to see mortgage rates back at levels that people have forgotten could ever exist. You're going to see the cost of a car loan back at rates that people thought had gone forever. And the government is going to find its debt interest bill rising extremely rapidly. Now, this all sounds horrendous, and it would be initially, but the silver lining is that it might eventually force Congress to start behaving like other people's money counted for something. Because I don't see any evidence that they've done that for the last 16 or 17 years, and that's how we got into this hole. But, you know, if you spend a very long time not paying any price for your actions, that's kind of what you do. You do more of the same. But I do think we're getting close now to a point where actually, you know, the check for this 17-year-long free lunch finally lands, and we realize that actually it's a lot bigger than we thought, and so we have to change our ways.
And maybe it's just the rain there, Ian, but you're really depressing the hell out of me right now.
Yeah, but GDP was nearly 4%, so that's fine.
Yeah. Well, I guess so. Well, let's talk about, you know, a couple of pieces of good news. We had consumer confidence that came in today again at record levels, though I think I read your note saying it's probably not going to stay where it is. But then we get a jobs report on Friday that should be, you know, another close to 200,000 plus jobs. So some of the data is coming in strongly. Do you think consumer confidence can stay as high as it is and we'll just keep cranking out these 200K or so job growth numbers for the foreseeable future?
I think there'll probably be some hit to consumer confidence next month when people get their, you know, their 401k statements and see that the drop in the stock markets cost them some money. But, you know, the levels of these numbers are so high that even, you know, a significant knock for a couple of months isn't going to put them at any sort of place where I would look and say, you know, this is a weak report. That's just not going to happen. And it's just demonstrating, really, that if you throw enough money at people and enough money at the economy for long enough, then, you'll get growth and that'll make people happy. Sustainability is the issue to me rather than the current picture, which is great. The payroll picture, again, you know, when the economy is growing at 3.5% or 4%, you're going to need a lot of people. And so businesses are trying frantically to hire. And in fact, just over the last few months, again, since the stimulus has kicked in, some of the hiring numbers that I follow have literally gone off the chart. And I have to redraw the axis every time I want to put the latest data point on because they're so strong. Now, I don't think there's any way that companies can find as many people as they want to hire, which of course pushes the unemployment rate down and pushes wages up. But it certainly means that from a headline perspective, you know, you're getting strong GDP growth, strong consumer spending, strong employment numbers, and probably a lower unemployment rate. The one wrench in the works for the payroll number that's going to come out Friday is the hurricanes, because Hurricane Florence depressed the numbers in September, and Michael probably will have some impact in October. We won't really get a clean read on the payroll numbers until the December report. But, you know, behind all this noise, and this is the first time ever, by the way, that I can find that we've had hurricanes making landfall on the continental U.S. in the payroll survey week in two successive months. So we're kind of flying blind here. So I'm pretty much prepared for anything on Friday. But that's noise. Step back from the noise. Look at the surveys. Look at what businesses are saying. They just can't get enough people. So for the foreseeable future, it's going to look great. But it has consequences. And the consequence is that we're making a tight labor market even tighter at a time when the Fed has interest rates by historic standards at an extremely low level. And I think that they're going to get increasingly nervous about whether they can bring the economy to the place they want it to be before it gets to be so tight that inflation spikes up again.
So we're getting close to the end of our time. I find that people can tolerate listening to economic nerds like us for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes at that point. You know, they want to move on to something else. So I want to ask you two final things relatively quickly. The first is on immigration. Republicans have talked about obviously limiting illegal immigration or cracking down or, you know, whatever it is that they're doing. But there is an overarching desire as well in some parts of the Republican Party to limit legal immigration. Doesn't seem like a great idea when the labor force is as tight as it is now.
No, I mean, it's obviously not. It's not based on any sort of rational economic analysis. It's politics, and it's playing to the identity of Republican voters. But from a macro perspective, it really is just dumb as a rock to limit immigration. One of the great advantages that the U.S. has over all of the developed economies is that there is permanent, massive excess demand for immigration from highly qualified, very smart people who will only make the economy stronger and the country stronger. And you know, the U.S., after all, is a country that's built on immigration, initially from my neck of the woods, but subsequently from all over the world. And I view this as one of the enormous strengths of the U.S. And to be curtailing this voluntarily just strikes me as being absolutely mad. You know, and pretty much anyone in the business sector, especially in the tech sector, would I think echo that. And so, unfortunately, what seems to be economically sensible has been caught up in the political crossfire. And you know, I don't really see any meaningful change in this anytime soon. I'm sure Democrats, if they take control of the House, will be keen on some sort of loosening of immigration, but it'll die in the Senate or in the White House. So nothing will change in the short term. And it's just a case of, you know, politicians shooting themselves in the foot for very short term gain and not really thinking about what the country actually needs.
Okay. Lastly, and we'll let you go on this one. The Trump argument is that the Obama economy sucked and his economy is great. Are there huge differences between the Obama economy and the Trump economy?
No, not really. I think the reason that they can make that argument is that in 2014, 15, even through to early 16, so in the latter stages of Obama's term, the economy was slowing. But it was slowing because oil prices collapsed. Now, in the olden days, lower oil prices used to be good for the U.S. because they'd boost consumers, cheaper gas, and there wouldn't be much impact on the rest of the economy. That's not the case now. In the shale world, actually, lower oil prices are bad for the U.S. Consumers get cheaper gas, true, but actually the hit to capital spending in the shale business was bigger than the gain to consumers. And that was from mid-2014 to early 2016. So the latter stages of Obama's presidency, the economy looked like it was weakening. It was picking up in early 16. To be very clear, it was picking up before Trump was elected. But he's been able to ride that rebound, which has got nothing to do with him and everything to do with oil prices going from 25 back to 70. That's reinvigorated the shale business, which was on its knees in late 2015, early 16. And so, you know, like any politician would do the same thing. It's down to me. No, it really isn't.
Very good. Ian Shepherdson joining us live from rainy Newcastle. We appreciate your taking a little time to join us on Politico Money.
That was fun. Thanks, Ben. Bye.
Bye. That's a wrap for the latest Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. And if you're liking the show, please do rate us and write a written review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next time on Politico Money.